Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, he has written a new book about Fresno's role in World War II, but his own experiences in the Army are pretty memorable as well.
Sure, we could hear the bullets going over our heads, and I thought I was going to die. It was the only time during the war that I really thought I was going to die.
We're thankful he didn't, and we're glad to bring you this 88-year-old story today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you're on the AM side of your dial at News Talk 580 or the FM half at 105.9, maybe even online at kmjnow.com, you know that each week we catch up with veterans, mostly from the World War II generation. We want to thank them for their service, for the sacrifices they've made for the sake of our freedom. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten and be educated a little bit along the way about what life was like for members of our greatest generation way back when. We're in for a double dose of it today, not just a veteran's story, but really a city's story from World War II. I'm pleased to have on the program today George Gruner. Maybe you know that name. If you've ever read the Fresno Bee, or at least did for a long time, you probably recognize his name. And if you've read a new book that we're going to talk about, you're going to recognize his name too. But let's start before you ever worked for the Fresno Bee. There was another newspaper that that you worked for in the Bay Area. And I'm curious, as a young man growing up in the Bay Area, so close to the ocean, I've heard stories about blackouts in December of 41 and the reaction to what happened. I like to ask every veteran what they remember, what he remembers about that day. December 7th, 1941, remember where you were and how you found out?
Yes, I believe almost everybody who was around above the age of six or seven must remember where they were on that day and at that time. I was playing sandlot football. I was 16 years old, and I was playing sandlot football on midday-ish. I think it was about 10 o'clock our time. There was a half dozen of us out in a field playing sandlot football. Somebody came by and said, "They're bombing Pearl Harbor. The Japs are bombing Pearl Harbor." And we said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" Well, and then we said, "Well, what's the next play?" And we went on with our game for a few more minutes at least. And then we got to thinking about it and thinking, well, gee whiz, this is pretty significant. Maybe we ought to go in and find out what's going on. Of course, we never really thought much about how it would affect us. Remember, we were 16, and no one expected that the war would last long enough for us to become involved.
It sure would, but before you got involved in the war, you got involved in what would be a lifelong career for you, the newspaper business.
Absolutely.
What was your first job there at the Oakland Tribune?
I was a copy boy. In those days, it was not unusual for people to go to work right out of high school. And with the war coming along, a lot of people working in newspaper jobs were going off to the service. So I went into the Oakland Tribune in early January of 42 and got a job as a copy boy. Actually had to get, I was still in high school at the time, but my grades were sufficient so that I could get out of school for that period. And I was graduating in the class of January 42. So I got my day off changed from my copy boy job and went back to school to graduate. And as it turned out, that job at the Tribune was very good because, as I say, many men went off to the service, and within a very few months, I was a cub reporter at the great salary of $21 a week, much better than copy boy pay, which started at $16 a week. But anyway, it turned out that my copy boy experience served me in good stead much later.
And we're going to hear about that. It actually came into play when you were in uniform. So you're a teenage reporter for the Oakland Tribune, but then you turn 18, and that was going to be it because Uncle Sam was ready to get a hold of you, huh?
Yeah, he was. And, you know, if I had been thinking about that, I probably would have gone into the Navy because I was a Navy buff. I still am. I still like to read naval stories. But
and write them, too.
And write a naval history, yeah, the Battleship California. But I was having such a good time as a cub reporter, you know. It was in the days of Hot Type and Hello, Sweetheart, Get Me a Rewrite and that kind of thing. And it was a lot of fun, and I was concentrating on that. Didn't really give a thought much to what was coming up. But I turned 18 in February of 1943. And in April of 1943, I got my greetings from the President of the United States, and off I went.
What were you thinking at that point? Because here you have all this ambition, you're having so much fun as a reporter, and now all of a sudden your life has changed a little bit. Was that hard to swallow at first?
Not really, because I think most of us at the time, we all knew that we had our part to play in either in a civilian way or in a military way, and we all expected probably that we would be called to the service, but I was actually thinking of that maybe I could get a job at Stars and Stripes, the Army newspaper. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't get one then, but I went back in the 50s and worked for Stars and Stripes for a couple of years before I came to Fresno.
Mm-hmm. But at this point, you had a job to do, and they put you in an anti-aircraft unit?
Yes, actually, we spent a few days at Presidio Monterey, and then they put us on train, shipped us down to Riverside and to Camp Hahn, which was across the road from March Field, which is still there. Camp Hahn has disappeared, but Camp Hahn was a training base for anti-aircraft units. And I joined a battalion there, the 817th, and I trained for just about a year in anti-aircraft. But here again, my background in at work at the Oakland Tribune, where I learned to work a switchboard, along with having the ability to type, which I learned in school, why they put me in headquarters battery, and I was started off in a communications section and ultimately moved over into the S2 and S3 operations section.
And you had deluxe accommodations down there, right?
Yeah, we had facilities like I've never seen anywhere else. There were wooden huts, which sheltered six men, and basically they were just plywood tents. They had drop sides over screens all the way around the building, and in the daytime, when it was pretty warm in Riverside, they propped up these wooden drop sides. And then at night, we'd drop them down because you could look out from our base and we could see the snow in the mountains. So it was pretty cool at night. But in the daytime, they like to air them out some.
And I guess you weren't complaining about those accommodations once you got out in the desert a little more and lived in a tent for a while?
Yeah, when our outfit, almost all the outfits from Riverside, trained out at Camp Irwin, it was called in those days. Today, it's the main Middle East training base.
Right.
Very, very elaborate now. In those days, it was mostly tents. There were big tents, and big pyramidal tents in those days. But when you went on the firing line, while you were in pup tents out on the extreme edge of the desert, which happened to be just a range or so away from Death Valley, I spent 14 weeks in a pup tent out there, and the main damage from that, or potential damage, was rattlesnakes and scorpions.
Was that a daily occurrence?
Oh, yeah, every day. You, in the morning, you'd shake out your shoes to to make sure there were no scorpions warming up in there. And at night, while you shook out your sleeping bag to make sure no rattlesnakes decided to get warm that night.
Well, if you can handle the rattlesnakes and the scorpions, then I'm sure the Germans or the Japanese would be no big deal.
Well, that was entirely different when we got into the real situation. As it turned out, my outfit that I trained with down there, we trained up and down the coast, actually. We got up as far as Santa Maria and Estrella over by San Luis Obispo and training exercises. But when they finally got down to push to shove, the Army at that time did not substitute units. They substituted individuals. And we got in what was known lovingly as the REPL depots, the replacement depots.
Right.
And I spent more than 6 months in a REPL depot, unassigned, no pay, getting all of the dirty jobs that came along the way as we moved from, at that time, from Fort Bliss, Texas to the overseas situation. I got as far as the East Coast when the invasion took place. Mm-hmm. And I went across the Atlantic on the Queen Elizabeth with 15,000 other guys. We literally had 15,000 men on that ship. And it was an interesting experience, but we sailed alone, and that shortened it a lot. Elizabeth was fast enough, so she went across in about 5 days.
Didn't have to worry about the subs that way, huh?
That's right. We zigzagged all the way, and
yeah.
So they stayed away from the submarines. But they also flew air patrols over the Queens. They weren't gonna lose any of the Queens. So anyway, we got to England, and along about that time, it's August or so of 44. The Army, in its wisdom, decided that they didn't need any aircraft replacements. There weren't too many casualties in anti-aircraft outfits, but they had a lot of them in the infantry, and they needed 521 basic riflemen very badly.
And had you had any training in that kind of thing at all?
Not basically, no. We all carried M1s, the standard weapon of the time. In fact, we guys in the aircraft were always very jealous of the field artillery guys, because those artillerymen carried carbines or 45s, Army 45 pistols. The anti-aircraft guys were forced to carry the M1s, which we managed to hide most of the time when we weren't required to be out there in formation with them. But the Army said, well, we'll retrain you guys as infantrymen now. Well, they gave us 30 days training. By that time, we were at Warminster Barracks in England. And they took us out in the field and said, here, this is a BAR. And they handed us this great big Browning automatic rifle, about twice the size of a regular rifle.
Twice the weight, too, huh?
Oh, yeah, weight, too.
Plus the ammunition you had to carry.
Tripod mount on the front. In fact, in the BAR, they usually had a two-man team. One guy carried the ammo, and the other guy carried the gun. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so they said, here, hold that up and pull the trigger. And we held it up and fired a half a dozen rounds, and they said, okay, you're qualified with the BAR now. And they gave us a grenade and said, pull the pin and throw it over the wall and duck. Bang, off went the grenade. All right, you're qualified with a grenade now. Anyway, that's what we went through.
Did that make you feel a little more expendable?
By that time, we were pretty much unhappy troops. You will hardly find a fellow who served in the REPL depots. Mm-hmm. Who was happy with the time he spent there, because it meant all of the dirty details. I could be more explicit in how he described them. KP almost every other week from dawn till 10 o'clock at night. In fact, we got to the point where whoever got stuck with KP would steal canned food, fruit, stuff like that, to feed the rest of the tent. And it was a standard arrangement. If you're on duty tonight, mm-hmm. Why, you're going to get enough for us guys to eat tomorrow.
Right.
Anyway, we did all of that, and we ultimately I crossed the channel on a cargo liner called the Leopoldville. And anybody who wants to read up on that should really do so, because the Leopoldville was a ship from the Belgian Congo registry, had a Congolese crew. We crossed the channel in it and landed at Omaha Beach because Cherbourg had not been cleared yet. The harbor was not open. This was not close to the invasion. I don't want to create that impression. It's about D plus 60. Mm-hmm. But they were still going ashore at Omaha Beach. We didn't think anything of crossing the channel. We assumed by that point it was like a British lake. Well, as I say, that was along about September, probably be September.
All right.
And as I say, I mentioned the ship specifically because I'm down in the hold with a hold full of other guys coming ashore in France without any thought to the English Channel. Well, on Christmas Eve of 1944, the Leopoldville was torpedoed by a German submarine. And it stayed afloat for about 4 hours, but it was Christmas Eve, and every signal that went ashore to American troops and everybody else and naval forces and so on, every place they ran into the fact that everybody was off at a Christmas Eve party. Mm. And as a result, we lost a lot of American troops, I think about 400 men, as I recall, that drowned in the channel when they could have been saved if our people had been alert and on the ball.
And this is the same ship that a couple months earlier you had been on thinking nothing of it.
Thinking nothing of it, thinking we're just crossing like a pond somewhere, like we're up on Lake Millerton or something.
It's time for our first break now. We'll get more of the implications when we come back. Go to KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to explore some of the photos and links relating to George Gruner's story. You can even find out how to buy his new book about Fresno's role in World War II. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 88-year-old George Gruner of Fresno, California. I don't want to gloss over his World War II experiences just to tell you about his book. So this is one of the rare occasions in which the interview is going to extend to next week's show as well. We'll cover everything he did in World War II today. And then next week, we'll get into his book, Into the Night, which covers what Fresno's role in World War II was. You can find that book at the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno, home of the Legion of Valor, also at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. And if you'd like to get the book and have Mr. Gruner sign it for you, head out to Chandler Field 2 weeks from today. He'll be out there from 9:30 to 2 on May 4th as part of a celebration of Fresno's aviation heritage. Chandler Airport is at 510 West Kearney Boulevard. That information is on our website at kmjnow.com. And again, that's next Saturday, May 4th from 9:30 to 2. When we left off, he remembered crossing the English Channel on the SS Leopoldville, a ship that would end up infamously torpedoed and sunk by a German U-boat on Christmas Eve 1944. That story is fascinating in its own right. 763 American soldiers died in that catastrophe. The wreckage of the Leopoldville has since been recovered. I've got some links to some of that information at kmjnow.com, so check it out there. But for now, let's get back to Mr. Gruner's story.
So anyway, I was still in the Rappeldeppels at this point. I got up to the Belgian-German border. This is end of October, first part of November. At this point, there was a lot of fighting going on in the Hürtgen Forest. 1st Division was taking heavy casualties there from tree bursts of our incoming artillery going down into the foxholes and killing a lot or wounding a lot of the men. So we all assumed that our package of about 200 men were going to end up in the 1st Division. One day at this last outpost of the Rappeldeppels, a forward replacement depot, they call them, they called my name and seven other guys. And they said, to get your gear, you've been assigned. We said, oh, yeah, where are we going? He said, to the 440th Anti-Aircraft Battalion. Anti-aircraft, we all said, eagerly. And they said, yeah, that's right. They called for certain guys with certain intelligence spec numbers. Well, that spec number that I had related back to the training I had received with the 817th, but also back to my early training as a copy boy at the Oakland, well, that part didn't, but it comes up as part of the story. So they assigned us to this outfit, was being set up on the Buzz Bomb Belt. And the Buzz Bomb Belt was a series of battalions which the Army set up along an allegedly quiet sector of the Western Front, where they put a couple of untried divisions in and just let them kind of tool up there. And then they assigned about four battalions of anti-aircraft to shoot down buzz bombs. Now, the buzz bombs, of course, were the V1s and the V2s. The V2s we couldn't do anything about because they went up into space and then came back down. But the V1s were the standard putt-putters that flew over Liège and a couple of Brussels and also London. And they sounded like washing machines chugging along very slowly in a nice straight line. And the idea was we would shoot them down before they got over the cities that they were destined for. So, well, we tried shooting down a couple of them and found out that when you shoot them down, they come down on top of you. So from then on, we decided the thing to do was to inform the Air Force, primarily the Royal Air Force. And these guys were so trained that they would go out and meet them over the English Channel. And they'd fly up alongside them, and they had the V1s had short, stubby wings. Mm-hmm. And they would fly up alongside them with their fancy Spitfires and so on, and would go up and nudge them with their wing, flip them over, and they'd go down into the channel. And so that's how a lot of that went on. But it so happened that when I got to this outfit, the 440th, with these seven other guys, they looked at my records. And they said, well, you can type. And I said, yeah, I can type. And they said, well, you can work a switchboard. Well, yeah, I said, I learned to work a switchboard as a copy boy at the Oakland Tribune because we had a PBX board right in the newsroom. Mm-hmm. And it had about 50 phones and about 10 trunk lines. And we worked the jacks and the plugs, and we knew learned how to do that as substitutes for when the regular operator wasn't on duty, which she would normally would work a straight weekday, mm-hmm. and then on Saturdays and so on, and at night why the copy boys would take over. So I had learned how to work a PBX board. So those were skills that they decided were something that they needed at headquarters battery. So they said, well, we're not going to send you out with these other guys. They're going out to a forward outpost in front of our line batteries where they can get an advance clue on the route of the B-1s. Mm-hmm. So we'll send somebody else out in your place. We'll keep you here in headquarters battery. So I stayed in headquarters battery for the rest of the war. And somebody else was taken from that unit and put in my place and sent out with these forward observers. And the forward observers were captured on the first night of the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow.
We learned later that they were marched to Czechoslovakia with practically no food. And by the end of the war, they were skin and bone skeleton types, mm-hmm. like the people coming out of the concentration camps.
A couple of questions here, and I want to hit on what you just talked about. One thing real quick, when you talk about the V-1s coming over the channel and the Spitfires bumping them, I think some people in their head say, wait a second, that's a bomb. Weren't they afraid of it blowing up? But those V-1s were set, so they weren't going to go off until they reached the distance that they were set for. Right?
Not only that, but they only went off on impact, mm-hmm. and they would fly up alongside of them, and they wouldn't impact them on the nose, which is where most of your fuses are rigged. They would come up along the wing and just flip underneath it and just flip it over, and down they'd go.
Not too different from the our valley pastime here of cow tipping, huh?
Well, possibly.
Aerial cow tipping.
Yeah.
So now you hit on, you're in this repo depot with 200 other guys.
Yeah.
And you're one of seven that gets pulled out.
Yeah.
And I imagine most of those 200 ended up in infantry
most
units.
Most of them ended up in the 1st Division.
Right.
In the Hurtgen Forest.
And many of them were killed, many more wounded.
I have no doubt.
I'm just statistically. Yeah.
Bound to, yeah.
So you dodge a bullet there.
I dodged a bullet, yeah.
And then, even more so, you don't go out with these forward observers. So you miss becoming a casualty and you miss becoming a prisoner of war.
Yeah.
Pretty fortunate.
I'm a fatalist, really, on the basis of that and a few other occasions. You know, as it turned out, the unit that I joined was in a town of called Hansfeld, Belgium, mm-hmm. which was on the road that led through the Losheim Gap. Mm-hmm. And the Losheim Gap, any student of the Battle of the Bulge will tell you, that's where it began with the crack troops of Task Force Piper. He was an SS major who led the firecracker brigade or something like that. That he had built a reputation as a real gung-ho soldier. On the night of the 16th, his forces were the first ones through the Losheim Gap, which had figured in all the wars why we decided, our military leaders in their wisdom decided that that was going to be a quiet sector, because for weeks we had heard their units, of the guys who were there, had heard a lot of machinery at night. Mm-hmm. And the daytime would come along and then no sign of it. Well, it was the buildup for the Battle of the Bulge.
And I've interviewed many Bulge veterans, some of them who were right there where you're talking about, and we're told exactly that. It's a quiet sector, and by the end of that night, they were POWs.
It turned out, I ended up in the intelligence section of the 440th.
This is the 440th AAA?
440th anti-aircraft AAA battalion. Mm-hmm. The only difference between the 817th and the 440th was that the 440th had half tracks, where the 817th back in the States didn't even have enough trucks to haul all their equipment. They had to borrow trucks whenever we moved, like from Camp Hahn out to the desert. Mm-hmm. But the 440th had half tracks and the gun batteries. As I said, I ended up in the intelligence section, and I saw intelligence reports coming down from SHAEF, Supreme Headquarters, AEF, that said there are nothing but old men and young boys in pillboxes in the sectors where you guys are. And that's, our intelligence was failing us mm-hmm. at that stage. And you'll find that true in most of the histories that we were just caught completely napping there.
And you guys weren't the only ones that were a little caught off guard. Your book has a great photo in it. And this book has nothing to do with the Battle of the Bulge and what was happening in Europe. Well, I guess in a way it does. Your book's about Fresno. We're going to talk about that. There's a picture of the great movie star in there who was not too far from you on that night of December 16th, huh?
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time, or I probably would have been over there trying to get in. But she was visiting. There was the, I think it was the 99th Division, had a rest area set up in Huntsville. And they had Marlene Dietrich was, of course, she was a native of Germany, but she was doing her part to entertain the troops both in the States and overseas at that time. And she just happened to be scheduled to give a performance in the town of Huntsville on the very day that the Battle of the Bulge started. And I've read in various books that the special services officer who was in charge of that particular rest camp, his first duties before he could really start thinking about the fact that the artillery barrages were starting to come pretty close, he had to get her out of there and well back and turn her over to some other special services person far behind the lines. But I'm afraid that a lot of GIs, at least those of us who survived, regretted the fact that she hadn't been there a day earlier.
Yeah, I suppose you did. What was your experience like December 16th, 1944? What did you hear? What did you see?
Well, I was here again. I was a pretty young guy in terms of combat skills. When the artillery barrage started to kick that thing off, I didn't know that it was anything out of the ordinary. I thought, well, this is what you experience when you are under an artillery barrage. And so we were told to load up. And they were going to move the headquarters out of Huntsville to join up with the 106th Division. Mm-hmm. If you've ever heard of the 106th, you know what happened to them. We never found them as we tooled out. But
the Germans did, though.
The Germans did. They found two regiments of the three. The fact was we're loading up, and I was out there throwing stuff in a truck when the shells were getting closer, and I was not skilled enough to know a close one from a distance one. I was out there, and somebody yelled at me to, "Gruner, get your butt in here." They're a little more explicit than that. And so I dove through a door, which turned out to be the barn instead of the kitchen. But anyway, I managed to avoid getting hit by any shells that night, which is another fatalistic experience. We ran for 4 days. I mean ran. The battalion ran. Everything was running. All of the roads mostly were at best two-lane roads, maybe one and a half lanes in a lot of cases. They were double traffic, all headed west. All headed west. Mm-hmm. And we ran. We were supposed to be looking for the 106th Division. Never found them. But after 4 days, we ran into German tanks heading east. Uh-oh. There were pincers movements that kept grabbing out in front of us, and ultimately they caught up with us down the road in Belgium. A group of us there got separated from the main body. We ran across a field, and the Germans couldn't get to us because of a blocked truck about a half a mile away from us. So they started shooting at us with machine guns. We thought we could hear the machine gun shells popping around us. And, bullets popping around us. So we dropped down into this field, and it was a field of little highs and low spots, and most of the low spots had ice water and it was melting, because this is December, remember?
The coldest winter on record.
Well, it was plenty cold. Well, certainly for me it was the coldest record on record. I had never seen snow fall. I'd growing up in the Bay Area, when I wanted to go to the snow, we waited a nice sunny day and we went up to Long Barn or some other snow resort. And I always saw snow on the ground. My first time that I saw snow fall was in Belgium in the Army. Mm-hmm. But anyway, when I got to this field, well, we dropped down in the field. Sure, we could hear the bullets going over our heads. And I thought I was going to die. That was the only time during the war that I really thought I was going to die. And I was afraid of how it would sound back in Oakland, but I was very calm, really. It's when there's nothing more you can do, why you reach a kind of a calmness. Mm-hmm. And anyhow, as it turned out, why the tanks finally gave up and went on their way, and We got up and ran off to the nearest road, which was not back to where our convoy was sitting. We went out to the nearest road, and here was another load of military coming out, one of the armored divisions. We jumped up on one of their trucks and rode out with them. During all of this time, the outfit was talking about back to Namur, which is on the Meuse River. And they had apparently spent an idyllic couple of weeks in Namur, so they thought was a good place to go to. And I was not with the unit at that time. But anyhow, we all headed out. I stayed with the group that were more experienced people and ended up in Namur. And sure enough, two batteries of our four came to Namur. And we joined up with them. And on Christmas Day, we were told that there's about 11 of us, I think, that we were the only survivors of headquarters battery, that they'd all been killed or captured. Mm. Higher headquarters had sent down a major to take command of the battalion, which normally is commanded by a lieutenant colonel. And they sent this guy down to take command. And he brought along a trailer loaded with wine. Where he got it, I know, but he thought that would pep us up a little if he brought us something. So on Christmas Day, we had a very sad meal. Nobody wanted much of the wine because we thought we'd lost headquarters battery. Well, about 2 days later, here comes headquarters battery with not a single casualty, not one. They came out. It was one of those, in the fog of war, the messages got garbled somewhere along the way. And the unit was reassembled in Namur. They sent this major, and he brought one man with him. The major and his driver sent them away, but we kept the wine.
And by then, you had something to celebrate. I have a few questions about some of that, but it's break time again. I think you can tell Mr. Gruner is a superb storyteller, and I bet you'd enjoy reading the new book he's written about Fresno during World War II. I have the information on that on our website, so go to kmjnow.com and keep it here for the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending the hour today with George Gruner, 88 years old. Next week, we're going to hear a little bit about his long career with the Fresno Bee, and we're going to hear a lot about his new book, Capturing Fresno's Contributions to World War II. When we left off, we were in December 1944. You talk about Piper's group of Panzer troops, and these were the troops later convicted of war crimes for the murder of prisoners of war. More than 80 on December 17th, and somewhere between 500 and 700 prisoners and civilians that were massacred by that very group of German soldiers over a span of about 2 months.
As I look at the map here of where you were to begin with, and you talk about fleeing west from those oncoming German troops. You go right past a city that has a name that's famous still today.
Yeah.
Malmedy.
Yes.
How close were you to what happened at Malmedy? Have you thought about?
Yeah, we've thought about that. We were very close. As it turned out, the way we were evacuating, we had headquarters battery and four line batteries trying to fit into the flow of troops moving, heading west, you know, running, literally running. And headquarters and two of our line batteries got through Malmedy. The two other line batteries did not get through Malmedy and diverted off on another road. And in the middle was the group that were captured and massacred at Malmedy.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt that we were obviously, here again, fate. It wasn't our turn. And we felt, of course, very sad about those guys. And after the war was over, a group of us made a trip back through the area we had served in there. And we made it a point to go to Malmedy to see that. By that time, they were building some sort of a monument there. But it was
I've got a picture of you here, and right behind you is the scaffolding around a big cross.
Looks like a big cross, yeah, yeah.
And I imagine you had had some newspaper experience beforehand, but with your three-plus decades in the newspaper business after the war, you came to appreciate the power, not just of the news, but of images.
Oh, yeah.
When was it that you first saw images of the aftermath of the Malmedy massacre, those famous photos of the bodies in the snow and the ice? And what did that do to you when you realized what had happened so close to where you were?
Well, you know, you look at bodies, you can find pictures of bodies almost everywhere. But, of course, the difference there was that these guys had surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
They had laid down their arms, and this had happened all along the way. And, in fact, it happened in Huntsville, too.
Mm.
And, in fact, if you read any of the detailed histories, Huntsville is mentioned because there was at least two, maybe three instances of GIs who were getting out of bed practically when Piper's group showed up, and they came out with white flags, mm-hmm. and they were machine gunned without a word. And so that kind of thing happened more than at Malmedy,
mm-hmm.
but Malmedy was such involved more people,
yeah.
and it was such a clear-cut instance that it's gone down in the history books. There's no excuse for that. But, of course, when the war was over, Piper, who was in command at the time, he was tried and put in jail rather than executed for a firing squad like some of the higher leaderships. But he should have been put up for a firing squad, too.
Sure. He certainly put many captives in front of his own firing squad. And I imagine when you heard things about that, whether it was Huntsville or Malmedy, but hearing that guys who had surrendered, instead of being taken prisoner, had just been executed on the spot, I imagine that didn't make you feel like you would ever want to be captured by German forces.
Well, no, although we hope that, you know, it depends a lot with the type of military units you were up against. The Wehrmacht, the regular army, those guys were just like Americans,
right.
or any other one. You know, you're called by your country, you go in, you do what you're told, you stand up, you train, and you go off, and they tell you to shoot at those guys over there, and you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I presume that was true with a lot of...
Good point.
Maybe a majority of the troops on the other side. We had no animosity, particularly to the individual. You fight as a country and mm-hmm. as a for whatever objective you're after, rather than individuals. And you hope that there is humanity on the other side as well.
Right, but what you found out with some of those SS troops,
some of those guys had none of that. That's true. Then.
And how did you spend the rest of your war? Because the Battle of the Bulge is ending in early 1945. There's still a few months left until
That's
Germany
right.
surrenders.
That's
What'd
true.
You do?
Well, the unit up to that point, we had pretty much served with the 7th Corps as Corps artillery. That is, anti-aircraft defending Corps artillery, which was the bigger units. Subsequent to that, the 440th was assigned after they didn't find the 106th Division. They were assigned to the 75th Division, which was also a relatively brand-new force coming over, getting their first taste of mm-hmm. of combat. From the as the Battle of the Bulge wound down, the 75th Division was taken out of the First Army and shipped down through the Third Army sector to the Seventh Army, which was first just coming into combat in the, I say down, I guess it would be up because it was down in France, but up in terms of the Rhine to close to the Swiss border around Strasbourg, where the First French Army had a sector. And we were actually assigned to the First French Army for operations and to the Seventh Army for rations and something else. But basically, the logistics were being served by the Seventh Army, but we were under the command of the First French. So we went from the First U.S. Army to the First French and the Seventh U.S. Army in the Strasbourg area, spent about a month down there, and then turned around. This is about a 200-mile road maneuver by a whole division. And then from that, we turned around and went from Strasbourg sector up pretty close to Switzerland to the U.S. 9th Army in Holland. So we turned around and drove that couple of hundred miles north again, this time to Holland, where we joined up with the 9th Army. And we served with the 9th Army moving across into Germany, and finally was involved in the crossing of the Rhine at Wesel, which is pretty much down in the flatlands. So I ultimately crossed the Rhine, which was maybe about 100 yards wide, very swift flowing on a pontoon bridge. But the bridge was built as part of a landing that involved paratroops, combat engineers who took their pontoons out there and built this floating bridge. And we crossed on that bridge, which was two troughs, metal troughs on pontoons. Mm-hmm. And the troughs were there so that your tires of your vehicles or your tracks would sit down in these troughs, and you couldn't steer. You know, you just stepped on the gas and went chugging across, bobbing up and down because of the weight involved in each section. And you spaced them out so that you didn't overstress the pontoon bridge. But that's how we crossed the Rhine, and then we were in the 75th Division was involved in the Ruhr Valley encirclement, actually. Some of the division was used as a pincers movement on the south. And actually, the anti-aircraft outfit was used as infantrymen, finally. Maybe that's where our training would come in use, except there was no combat at all at that point. By that time, everybody knew the war was going to be over soon. Nobody wanted to be killed in the last days of the war, including the Germans, and they didn't want to be captured by the Russians. Mm-hmm. So they were surrendering in droves, and actually the 440th captured the city of Duisburg.
So you wouldn't expect an anti-aircraft artillery unit to be capturing a city.
No.
How did that happen?
Well, as I said, the Germans were either pulling out of the Ruhr, but the Ruhr was a very industrialized section. You know, that's where all their factories were. But they were pulling out as fast as they could. In one sense, the officers were telling them, retreat, retreat, and we'll fight again another day. And the GIs, the German GIs, are saying, hey, I don't want to fight another day and get killed in these last days of the war. I'm going to find a way to surrender to the Allies. So the Army was utilizing every force that it had to take small sectors, and particularly if they knew that strength had been pulled out, why, they assigned many units, many targets to units that were not completely trained in hand-to-hand combat, so to speak.
So did you have many interactions with surrendering German prisoners?
Not so much with German prisoners, but one day we were in the city of Duisburg, when down the road came a unit in uniforms that looked very much like German army uniforms, marching in formation with an officer in command, marching very stiffly, as the Germans are wont to do. This guy came up to our unit, and we had a German-speaking officer. And he stopped these guys and said, "What are you guys doing?" He says, "Well, we're going back." It turned out that they were a unit of police, but they sure looked like soldiers to us. Mm-hmm. But they were policemen. And their commander, one guy in charge, and our officer said to him, "Well, you know, this is very dangerous. You could be killed. You could be shot at when you're just marching up the road like this." "Oh, no," said this officer, "I have a pass. I have a pass." Our officer says, "Let me see it." He pulls out a piece of paper on which had been written, "If this guy gives you any trouble, shoot the SOB." The end of the war.
He didn't know what he had there.
No.
Was there some celebration in your neck of the woods when the Germans surrendered?
Well, yeah, there was. Very quiet. You know, we fully expected it, so we knew it was going to happen. But we knew there was still a war going on out in the Pacific. But, yeah, we quietly celebrated. We'd lost a few guys, and there had been a lot of killings.
Mm-hmm.
But it was over, and then it was a question of, when could we go home? Well, it turned out we came up with a point system then, and as it turned out, I had 58 points. It took a while to get down to 58s, but here again, they were not shipping men not as units. They were shipping individuals again. The Repple-Depples turned around and started bringing people back to the States for 30 days leave and then off to join units headed for the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the crack units over there were brought back to the States for a little R&R, and then they were going to send them on to the Pacific, because that was going to be the really big one, because we knew that the invasion over there was going to be fantastic. If you've read anything on that since,
The
millions, the thousands of GIs who would die among the millions who would have been involved. So we expected that war was still going to go on. And as a matter of fact, I got as far as Camp Lucky Strike at Le Havre on the way back to the States when VJ Day came along. The orders were canceled, and so I stayed about an extra 6 months in Europe. But it turned out all right because I had a lot of free time. I got a furlough to Switzerland during that time. And then just about the time I got orders to come to the States, I got an offer to join Stars and Stripes. And I thought, but now I said, I'm going to go home, because I knew I had a job at the Oakland Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
So I came home, and I didn't get to Stripes until 1952.
One question I have. So you come home, you survived not only the close calls that you talked about, where moments where you thought you were going to be killed, but also these twists of fate where someone else was sent that could have been you.
Yeah.
So when you come home, still a very young man, I mean, you're what, 20 years old when you got home?
Yeah, I got out of the Army, I think 11 days before my 21st birthday, and then I was eligible to vote.
And you had experienced all of this, and you had come as close as you wanted to having your life come to an end. Did all of that give you a different perspective when you were back in this country with the war over?
Well, I suppose I think it probably matured me a lot faster than I would have at home. My military time was good for me, both in the States and overseas. And I believe that universal service would be good for our young people today.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Well, we thank you for your service to our country and for sharing your World War II journey with us today. We'll have more with Mr. Gruner next Saturday. We're going to find out how he ended up in Fresno, and we'll get the scoop on his terrific new book, Into the Night, which chronicles Fresno's contribution to the war effort all those years ago. Get all that info at kmjnow.com and join us again next Saturday for Hometown Heroes on KMJ.